Chapter 38, Anglo-Saxon Missionaries, Part 2, Boniface. Willibrord, of whom we told you in the previous chapter, labored with much blessing. He did not have an easy task. During his long life, he experienced many reverses and difficulties, but he persevered. However, more missionaries came over from England to the Netherlands. God sent still more servants. In the year 716, a relatively young man landed at Wyk by Duurstede. His name was Winfrith. From England, he had crossed over the North Sea, and after a safe voyage, he stepped ashore. Like Willibrord, Winfrith also had Anglo-Saxon parents. Hence, he was also related to the Saxons, which dwelled in the eastern part of the Netherlands and in Germany. Hence, he did not belong to the Franks. For many years, he had been brought up in English monasteries. There, he could have had the most profitable positions. But Winfrith was not after money and property. Already at a youthful age, the desire dwelled in his heart to go as missionary to the pagan world. Therefore, when he stepped on Netherlands soil, the long-cherished desire of his heart was finally fulfilled. Like Willibrord, he was also as happy as a child. However, he did not come to that country at a favorable time. Radbod destroyed what Willibrord had painstakingly built up. Willibrord himself had to leave the land of the Frisians and flee. Yea, what must Winfrith do now? Nevertheless, he decides to make an attempt. He travels to the city of Utrecht, and he is successful in speaking with Radbod. Kindly and with stress, he asks the king of the Frisians if he is allowed to preach the gospel in his country. However, Radbod will not even listen to him. With eyes that sparkle with rage, he denies Winfrith the admission into his country. Deeply disappointed, Winfrith returns to England. It is made impossible for him to labor there. There is joy in England when they hear that Winfrith has returned. Immediately, they appoint him as abbot of a monastery. Now then, henceforth, Winfrith can live calmly and peaceably. But yet, he is not satisfied. This is not his purpose. The desire remains alive in his heart to go to the heathens and also make known to those poor blind people the way of salvation. He yearned to cross over to those countries again. 2 years later, he decides to make another attempt. He embarks again and makes the voyage for the second time. However, he does not go directly to the Netherlands, but first he goes to the Pope of Rome. The Pope kindly receives him and sends him as a missionary of Peter. He receives the commission to go and preach in Germany. The Pope also gives him a collection of relics. Winfrith now hastens north, and for 3 years he works together with Willibrord. This zealous, tireless missionary is getting old. For that reason, he was very happy to get some assistance. Willibrord would have gladly kept the still youthful Winfrith with him, for then afterward he could succeed him. But Winfrith refuses. The Pope had appointed Germany as his field of labor, and he shall go to Germany. Winfrith does not allow himself to be persuaded. He bids farewell to his aged friend and departs. What shall await him there? He does not know. If I had to tell everything that took place during Winfrith's travels through Germany, then I would never get done. He labored there for many years. During his distant journeys, he was threatened by countless dangers. Many times, death grinned at him. However, Winfrith did not fear death, and he persevered. His preaching among those savage people was greatly blessed. Oh, many times, it seemed to be such a hopeless task. He experienced opposition and enmity. However, he did not permit himself to be discouraged by that. But yet one time we shall in thought go along with Winfrith on one of his missionary journeys through Germany. A group of men marched laboriously onward through the dark forests of the German province of Hesse. They are Winfrith and a few assistants. They carry a tent with them, so that at night they may set up a simple camp. That is very sensible of them, for then at night they are somewhat protected against the inclement weather. It is starting to get dark already, and the going onward becomes ever more difficult. But still Winfrith goes ever further. His assistants are tired and are looking for the time when they may rest. Suddenly they see in the increasing darkness in the distance the gleaming of a light among the many tree trunks. Oh, what can that be? Winfrith directs his steps thitherward. Being curious, his companions follow him. When they get closer, they notice a great multitude in the midst of the dark forest which had assembled there. The missionary soon discovers what is taking place. They are Saxons that live in the vicinity and who had assembled to celebrate one of their heathen sacrificial feasts. In the midst stands a giant oak which has been dedicated to Donar, their god of thunder. The entire population worship that tremendous oak as being sacred. At the base of that sturdy tree stands a large sacrificial stone. In the course of time, many offerings have been brought there. Also now, this evening, an offering shall be brought to Wodan. Unexpectedly, Winfrith appears at that place. I cannot tell you with certainty just how and what happened there. Many stories are in circulation about that. I shall tell you just one of those stories. Some writers tell us that in that evening a fine boy had to be killed. That boy of 12 years old must have been the son of the Saxon king. Winfrith was supposed to have prevented that at the last moment. And when the Saxons, having become enraged by the sacrilege of that stranger, threateningly pressed upon him to kill him, a heavenly light was supposed to have suddenly shone between the trees, whereby the heathens were frightened so much that they did not dare harm him, and thereby the life of the wretched boy was spared. Although this is a nice story, yet we must not attach too much faith to it, because it is quite fantastic. But one thing is certain. Winfrith had that sacred oak, which was consecrated to Donar, cut down by his assistants. Others tell us that the companions of Winfrith did not dare do that, and that the courageous missionary did it himself. However it may be, one thing is certain, that large, sturdy oak was cut down. That enormous tree fell down with a roaring crash. The many heathen spectators stared horrified at that which took place, and they expected nothing else but that Donar would destroy and kill those daring ones with his lightning. The vengeance of Donar, their thunder god, would strike those strangers. But when nothing happened, and Winfrith remained unharmed, they lost their confidence in their gods and listened attentively to the preaching of Winfrith. Many changed to Christianity. He had a little church built there where they could congregate together. The sacred tree, which he himself had cut down, supplied the necessary wood for the building of it. Thus, Winfrith traveled from place to place, and everywhere thousands turned away from paganism. He himself tells us that on that journey he himself has or had baptized more than 100,000 people. Through this incident, the power of paganism was broken in those regions. The Pope, who heard of this, was so happy that he called Winfrith to Rome. As a reward, he appointed him as bishop, and later even to archbishop. The Pope also gave him another name. He no longer called him Winfrith, but Boniface. That name really means benefactor. For that reason, from now on, we shall call Winfrith Boniface. Boniface acknowledged the Pope as head of Christ's church here upon earth. He swore allegiance to the Pope, and thus he actually became a missionary of Rome. That was pitiful, for the brave, zealous missionary erred in this. We know better, do we not? The Pope is not the head of the church. Christ himself is the head of his church. The Lord Jesus does not need the Pope as his assistant. He himself reigns over and governs his church here upon earth. Yet Boniface performed much labor. Everywhere he founded monasteries and built churches. It is a pity that he left some relics in all those churches. Personally, he attached much value to that worthless rubbish. Yea, he even believed that the relics possessed a preserving power. Boniface not only labored in Germany, but also in the Netherlands. After the death of Willibrord, he assumed the care of the Frisian church. Naturally, he could not accomplish the work of that large territory all by himself. For that reason, he had many assistants. However, he demanded of them all strict obedience to the Pope. In those days, many priests and monks lived in the worst sins. They were a reproach to Christianity. They were the cause why the Church of the Lord was being reviled by the pagans. Boniface took rigorous action against them. He dismissed and drove away those priests and monks that lived in an offensive life if they would not listen to him and persisted in their sinful life. Although Boniface acknowledged the Pope as head of the church, yet he dared to tell the truth to the Pope. Thus he has seriously reprimanded the Pope because he upheld such wicked priests and monks. But on the other hand, he went much too far in the acknowledging of the Pope. If there were priests that did not acknowledge the Pope, then they were persecuted by Boniface and put in prison. During his entire life, Boniface has striven to unite all the Christians in those countries into one Catholic Christian church, and that was also the Roman Catholic Church. To obtain that object, he could be extraordinarily strict. It was a good thing that he fought for unity, because God's church may not be divided and rent. All that division is really sinful. But it was wrong that in this he established the Roman Catholic Church. He erred in that. Perhaps you may ask, was Boniface then a Roman Catholic? Alas, then we must answer, yes, for the most part. From all this we notice that Boniface was too much Roman Catholic. It is true, one thing we must never forget. In those days there was only one church, the Roman Catholic Church. At that time, there were not as many errors as later. Only ages later, the Reformation would come, of which we hope to tell in its proper place. At the time of the Reformation, God would deliver his church out of the power of Rome. As long as that had not happened, God still had his people in the Roman Catholic Church. There has always been people of the Lord in the world, and that shall remain till the last day. Also in those days, there were children of God. For that reason, God maintained the Roman Catholic Church, notwithstanding the abominable apostasy and in spite of the serious errors. Why? Because the people of the Lord were still found in that church. And what about Boniface? In his preaching, he still presented Christ as the only Savior, as the only ground of salvation. But on the other hand, he had many errors, which were serious errors. We have already discussed his acknowledgement of the Pope. His adoring of relics has also been mentioned. He was no longer pure in the Lord's Supper. He believed that the bread and the wine were changed into the flesh and blood of Christ. Thus he even acknowledged the Popish Mass. What must we now say of Boniface? I do not know. I dare not say that he is lost. Neither dare I say with certainty that he is saved, because I could be mistaken in that. But happily that is not necessary. I do not have to judge nor condemn Boniface. God has judged him, and that was a righteous sentence. I am sure of one thing, God did not err. Let us hope that Boniface is saved. Once again, I want to point out to you with emphasis that in those days, the people of the Lord were still in the Roman Catholic Church. Only later, God would deliver his people out of the Roman Catholic Church. That would take place by means of the Reformation. As we have already told you, Boniface preached chiefly in Germany. Willibrord labored among the wild Frisians in the Netherlands, did he not? Those two undaunted missionaries have done much, very much, for God's church. Both were means in God's hand toward the extension of his kingdom. It is true, as we already know, they had errors. Boniface had more than Willibrord, but yet God wanted to use their preaching for a blessing of many, and just by those Anglo-Saxon missionaries, because that double hatred did not exist towards them. Willibrord died in the year 739. That was a heavy blow for the Frisian church, but also for Boniface, because thereby he became much busier. Boniface did not abandon the young Frisian church to its fate. Oh no, on the contrary, he took the care of the Frisian church upon himself. In addition to his own missionary field, he now had to take care of that field where formerly his friend Willibrord preached, and although he scarcely had any time for that, still, he did it because he felt himself obliged to do so. How hard has Boniface worked, isn't that so? It was a good thing, too, that Boniface had taken care of the Frisian church upon himself, because by renewal dark times dawned for that church. In 753, hence 14 years after the death of Willibrord, Radbod II became king of the Frisian people. This new king was another real pagan who did not tolerate Christianity in his country. Those Frisians who had accepted Christianity were terribly persecuted. While murdering and burning everything, Radbod II traveled through the country. Churches and monasteries went up in flames. Only heaps of smoking rubble were left. Priests and monks were killed by the hundreds. Yea, even the common Christians had to return to paganism, or else they were cruelly murdered by the savage pagan hordes of Radbod II, who spared nothing and no one. Radbod II would not rest until he had exterminated Christianity out of his land. He would not rest until the ancient worship of the gods had been restored again in its full glory. Besides, he was encouraged in this by the pagan priests, who had viewed with a jealous eye the progress of Christianity. How much blood and how many tears have been shed at that time? No pen can describe what the Christians have suffered at that time. Only God knows that. Boniface, who at that time was 74 years old already, hears that. He was told about the heavy afflictions which have come upon the Frisian church. And, brave old man that he is, he immediately hastens to the north. He himself shall visit the heavily afflicted Christians in Friesland. He himself shall comfort them. He himself by renewal shall preach the gospel in that land, where at that moment Christian blood is being shed in streams. Undaunted Boniface, how does he dare to go? Ah, when it concerned the Church of the Lord, then Boniface did not regard himself. Then he did not consider his age. Then he did not count the fatigue of such a journey. For then he went. And also that preaching was richly blessed. In spite of the vehement persecution, in spite of the perils of life to which they exposed themselves, thousands of Frisians had themselves baptized. Here, too, it was evident that the blood of the martyrs was the seed of the church. However terrible Radbod II did rage, he could nevertheless not destroy God's church. God himself took care that his church remains. Here again we see something of that terrible warfare between Christ and Satan, a warfare which shall continue to rage until Christ shall appear in the clouds of heaven. Only then, and not before, shall that warfare end. It is June the 5th, 754, the day of Pentecost. Slowly the sun rises above the horizon. That night a heavy dew hung above the Frisian fields, but through the warmth of the sun's rays, the heavy fog banks quickly disappeared. There is every indication that it shall become a beautiful summer day, a day of radiating sunshine. In the little town of Mermerwoude, close to Duckum, in the north of the province of Friesland, we find Boniface, the gray-haired missionary, and 53 assistants. Some writers tell us that they had arrived there in boats and now slept on the shore in tents. It is quite possible. Boniface and his assistants are already awake. Although it is still early in the morning, an active busyness prevails in the camp. They expect visitors this morning. Boniface has also preached in the north of Friesland. Also there his labor has borne fruit, because many Frisians have forsaken paganism and have become Christians. They have turned their back upon the service of the gods, and now on this day they shall be baptized. What a solemn moment that shall be. It is readily understandable that inwardly Boniface is happy. What farmer does not rejoice when he beholds the harvest ripening in the fields? Would not Boniface then be happy? He has also sown. He has also scattered the seed of God's word. And that seed has come up and has borne fruit in the hearts of those pagan Frisians. Now they shall be baptized. On this beautiful summer morning in June, it is still very quiet and peaceful. Entire nature breathes peace and rest. Listen, in the distance resounds a noise, very weak at first, but slowly on it becomes louder and clearer. The gray-haired Boniface hears that too, and a happy smile appears upon his wrinkled face. He thinks they are the converts who have come early to murmur Wouda. The noise swells into a roar. Suddenly, wild screams resound, mingled with cries for help. Boniface rushes hastily outside because he cannot imagine what it all means. Having come outside, he discovers to his horror that he is sadly mistaken. The Christians are not coming, but in this early morning hour, a raging, howling mob of pagan Frisians approach their camp. They are filled with hatred and rage toward the Christians. They shall kill those strange intruders. What are they doing here? They have no business here. Immediately, Boniface perceives that flight is impossible. The yelling mob is too close already. His assistants reach for the sword. They shall defend themselves and sell their lives as dearly as possible. But Boniface forbids them to do that. He says, "Just get the relics." He encourages the terribly frightened and alarmed assistants. He says, "Be not afraid of them that kill the body." What happened then is really too terrible to mention, but I may not conceal the truth. Behold, there stands the group of defenseless Christians with the gray-haired Boniface in their midst. Amid terrifying howls, those brutes come tearing along, clenching the heavy clubs in their muscular fists. With a roaring force, those pagans let those deadly weapons fall down upon the heads of the Christians, who, while dying, plunge to the ground. Also, the gray-haired Boniface falls bleeding to the ground. Yet one moment, and all is over. There lie those pitiful, mutilated bodies of 54 Christians, among whom is also Boniface. They all fell by the cruel violence of the pagan Frisians. While jeering and shouting, the mob turns back. They have performed their dreadful work. A profound silence descends upon the camp of the Christians, but it is the silence of death. The rumor of the abominable massacre is soon spread abroad. The sad news also penetrates the Frankish Empire. A vehement indignation fills the heart of all. It is indignation and sorrow. When the Frankish king hears of that, he decides to take vengeance. This atrocity shall not remain unavenged. A stop must be put to Radbod II's desire to kill. He marches to the far north with a strong army. The murderers are punished with much bloodshed, and their king Radbod II had to flee. All this is very well, but Boniface is dead. His bloody body is carried along by the Frankish soldiers to Utrecht and later conveyed to the monastery at Fulda. The little city of Fulda is situated in Germany. Thus he is buried in the country where he spent the greatest part of his life and where he labored with blessing for so many years. There his body rests till the last day. Then it shall arise. His labor has been carried on by others. God has maintained his church, and other missionaries have finished the work which he had begun. I could tell much about those missionaries and about their labor. One of them, a certain Ludger, has preached in Groningen. In spite of the opposition, this missionary has not brought the gospel in vain to the Groningen country. Nice stories, but I cannot tell everything, for then I would never get done. For that reason, we shall let the other missionaries rest. Here we are concerned about the great line which also runs through these histories, the line of God's reign, the line of God's eternal faithfulness. However, by this time we surely have understood how much strife and trouble it was cost to bring Christianity into the Netherlands. Those people have given their blood and life for that. The service of the Lord was worth everything to them. They have sacrificed their strength for that. However much Satan exerted his power to prevent Christianity, he was not successful. King Jesus has conquered. Paganism had to yield. God always works irresistibly. What is the Lord's service worth to us? Concerning this, let everyone examine himself. Let each of us give an answer to that.